Can you guys hear me? Sort of. Yeah, I'll move it up my tie, that's all. Good afternoon. Welcome to the town hall meeting. I made it too loud. Lower it down on the tie. Are you going to adjust it? Okay, here we go. So this is a regular town hall meeting of the Faculty of Medicine. I'm David Eidelman. I'm the dean, in case you don't know who I am. We have a typical agenda. The primary purpose of this meeting really is to talk about research, but we will engage in some of the other business. I would remind folks, if you're not aware, that we have a consultation going on or a process going on to, these are in lieu of faculty council meetings, but we will be establishing a formal faculty council in the Faculty of Medicine in the near future. Michael Chevelle has been working with the committee to develop that, and we discussed it at our deanery meeting recently, so you'll be hearing more about that, and these meetings will probably become a bit more formal. While waiting for that, we will continue with our usual agenda, first of an in memoriam for people who have died since the last meeting. I will talk a little bit about the health system reform budget and our international activities, and I hope to reserve after a very few questions, reserve most of the time to discuss research, which is a topic that doesn't always get its full coverage. And so for that, we have Philippe Coe and Sherry Baum, who will be speaking to that. So as people come in, I wanted to ask for a moment's silence to just remember these folks that some or all of you will have known, Firm Kramer Azima, Yves Clermont, Jack Diamond, and Rosalind Goodman. Thank you very much. So, those of us who are working in the clinical departments or who are associated with clinical departments have been spending very much of our time in the last few weeks talking about something called le projet de loi 10, the healthcare system reform. The reason I bring this up is, in case some of you don't know, this will have a profound impact on the future of healthcare in Quebec. And the basic premise of the law is this is a map of Quebec, and it's showing all of the agencies, healthcare agencies around Quebec. At the present time, there's roughly 182 different agencies, institutions of various kinds, hospitals, and so on and so forth, all kinds of different bodies that are involved in administering the healthcare system. The goal is to move this to 28. So that's a big... So if you're a bureaucrat, this is obviously an improvement, right, by definition. In fact, if you get 28 down to, like, 1, it would be even better. So the idea is to streamline administration by having fewer entities and having those entities cover a broader range of the population. And most importantly, there's a theoretical advantage of integrating institutions that cover different kinds of care. You have, a general hospital, a rehabilitation institution, a chronic care institution, as well as frontline services. You integrate them totally. This is the sort of model that you may have heard of in places like Kaiser Permanente, where they do this extremely well in California and elsewhere. But, of course, this is Quebec, so the main focus so far of the reform is on structure rather than function. They're very good at organizational charts here in Quebec. Because this is even more complicated in the Montreal region, where we have two universities working and multiple different communities. And so there was a think tank called Montréal Métropole en Action, which was led by the current agence, on which several of our colleagues sat, but in which Sam Benaroya in particular played a key role, along with his counterpart from the Université de Montréal, in terms of figuring out how to divide things up. And in the end, we end up with five areas in the island of Montreal, West de Lille, Centre de Lille, which is actually going to be called Centre-Ouest, the North region, Southeast, and East. of these, the Center West and West will be are part of the McGill Ruiz currently, and they would continue to be. So what are these things? The Center West includes the Jewish General, St. Mary's Hospital, Saint-Oisès de la Montagne, Saint-Oisès Cavendish, places like Maimonides, Miriam Home, and so on. Lots of different organizations. The West de Lille includes Verdun, La Salle, Lachine, and Lakeshore hospitals. And you may ask, what happened to the MUHC in this? The MUHC is a standalone, so-called super-regional entity, which is, we're not exactly sure what it does. I wish it were funny as it sounds. So in the context of this being very important, there was a lot of discussion among all the deans between the different medical schools, the rectors, everybody. And this discussion is ongoing. You'll see it in the newspaper. Akes just put a memoir to the National Assembly saying this is crazy and stupid. We also put in a memoir, and I thought I should at least tell you what we said. So I had the privilege of returning from a trip and being whisked off to Quebec City with Pascal and Olivier Marcel, the VP Governmental Affairs, where we appeared before Gaétan Barrette, the Minister of Health, and his friends, as well as the opposition. And we tried to get across certain messages. These, first of all, focused on the teaching and research mission, where we wanted to make sure that after this healthcare reform, university designations for healthcare facilities would continue, that the bill would continue to support the research and teaching missions. This wasn't very clear. It was stated in the draft bill, but it hasn't been made very clear, that each institution would have an appropriate committee for governance structure that was set up as it should be. We wanted to have board representation on these establishments that were designated by the university. We wanted to make sure, unlike what it said in the board, that it isn't only the minister who gets to pick all the players. In the current version of the law that's been proposed, the minister picks the directors general, the associate directors general, the president of the board, and all the members of the board. So it isn't exactly clear what kind of governance structure this is. I made a strong case that merging things together, merging the Jewish with St. Mary's, with Cavendish, with De La Montagne, with Maimonides, with all these things, and then having a single board overriding them, had the risk of making these organizations just departments of the Ministry of Health. And as I pointed out, no one is going to give donations to the Ministry of Health. And they laughed in the National Assembly also. But this is actually a crucial issue for us from a research point of view, and especially particularly because, as you know, in institutions like the Douglas, which will be in the CIS West de Lille, and the Jewish, which will be in CIS Centre West, these institutions depend very much on philanthropy to make their research programs work. And so this is a very serious issue for us. And we talked a lot about trying to reinforce what is in the law, the bill, which is to have the comité consultatif, the consulting committees, consultative committees, to make them more robust and ensure that there's community engagement so people still feel they're part of, they have a role in the hospital. It's not just run by some faceless board somewhere that nobody knows who the people are. So we gave this. It was very warmly received, and then we got stuck on the way back because our car broke down. But we also recommended that they reinforce the mission of the Ruiz. We said that, and there was also another memoir, this one presented by the four Ruiz. Remember, the Ruiz are the academic health networks. So there's Ruiz Montréal, Ruiz McGill, Ruiz Sherbrooke, and Ruiz Laval. And Sam Bournaroya was one of the people who went to present this, and so they went to talk specifically about the Ruiz, because it turned out the Minister of Health didn't actually know anything about the Ruiz. When we mentioned to him, he said, the Ruiz is very interesting, but it's not in the law. It actually is in the law, and Sam and his colleagues went to reinforce the idea that these sort of academic health networks are really important for making sure that the healthcare system works properly, and also with these different regional health authorities, the so-called CIS, that they have to continue to be coordinated through Ruiz and have a reinforcement of their academic missions. So I'm trying to remember if we have any more on that. No. So that's where we are with that. I'm gonna hold for questions till I finish my little update, because I'm hoping you'll ask questions about the budget instead. So while this is going on, the ancient Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. We simultaneously, while they're turning over the entire healthcare system, financial exigencies mean that there is enormous pressure on all publicly funded organizations. So the pressure on the hospitals is extraordinary. I heard that there's an enormous budget pressure coming on the MUHC. I'm sure it'll be true on the other institutions. And we just heard today that the universities will have, within the same budget year, an additional $63 million budget cut. Is that the right numbers? 32. In my mind, it was 63. 32, an additional 32 on top of what was already asked earlier this year. So that we don't know yet what this will translate at this level. Because of this, many of you may have seen Dr. Massey's forums on the budget. And you may know that there is a hiring freeze that's been put in place. We were actually officially informed about it today, but it's effectively in place for hiring on the university core budgets, the one that come from the government. So this is the 1A and 1B budget. There is no hiring freeze for hires on the FOPLs that start with a 2, right? Do I have it right? 3 years. I finally know something about budget. The bad news is, of course, this is going to be unpleasant. The relatively good news is our faculty is somewhat protected because we have revenues that come from other sources than the core government budget. But it means that it will be difficult, for example, to replace people who are permanent employees who retire or who depart. At this point, there is no talk of, letting people go. It's just a question of things being quite tough. So we have this dual opportunity of budgetary pressure as well as healthcare transformation. So what am I doing about that? This is always the question. So I can't do anything about the healthcare reform except give my recommendations, which we're continuing to do, to try and influence the next version of the bill, of La Loi 10, of Bill 10, to be more consistent with the needs of universities and more protective of the interests of local communities. For the budget, we're trying our best to manage it with as little impact on day-to-day operations as possible. But we are trying to look for additional revenues. And I just thought people should be aware that several people, myself, but other people in this room and elsewhere in the Faculty of Medicine are working hard to try and identify appropriate international opportunities, which are the type where we, in exchange for resources, we help people develop capacity in their own area. We're not interested in doing foreign campuses or McGill, Singapore, or anything like that. We're talking about things where we are hired as consultants. So in the last few weeks, there have been interest from China, Egypt, Greece, quite a lot of interest from Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Poland, Qatar, and the Emirates. I think that's it. So people should know that there is this going on. This is actually starting to take shape in, obviously, for the medical school. This is the traditional thing, especially for residency training. But increasingly, we're starting to hear interest from nursing, P&OT, and research. And so there may be opportunities for units to supplement their revenues by getting involved in this. We're trying to be very cautious and careful about how we approach this so that we don't end up in any sorts of arrangements that will either compromise us financially or which go against our values. Of making sure that we're creating a value for the population that we're serving and not just creating business opportunities. So with that, I will stop for a few minutes for questions before asking my colleagues to discuss research. Yes, Dr. Yes. David.
So thank you for that review, particularly of Bill 10, which obviously is causing a fair amount of discussion amongst the different institutions. So sort of rotating through the different institutions and feeling sort of the vibrations on the wall, I know that the individual institutions have made either recommendations or responses to the ministries. So the question I have is, within the framework of the McGill University Healthcare Network and the RUIS, how much discussion and vetting are these individual responses to the ministry from the individual healthcare institutions? Is our mechanism sophisticated enough that these things are aired and discussed before they go forward because they seem to be causing angst at the individual institutions?
So I'm tempted to plead the Fifth Amendment, but we're in the wrong country for that. So the answer is, unfortunately, not as much as I would have liked. I would have liked to see some coordination among the different messages. Our message was fairly universalist in its approach, and decidedly so. But each of the healthcare institutions has taken a very, I'll call it, defensive stance. So the MUHC just sent out, made official today, a memoir which is all about its super-regional status, which is in the law, in the proposed law, but nobody knows what it means, so they've tried to define it. The JGH has tried to influence the bill by indirectly through other channels to try and get retain its board as it had before and not be merged. The St. Mary's is working on its own on another strategy, and Douglas has banded together with the two other university mental health institutes to send their chiefs of psychiatry to give a brief about the importance of mental health. You will note in the bill there's almost no mention at all of mental health, and the minister was surprised when I brought it up with him that this was a problem. That had anything to do with the bill. I'm sure he knows that mental health is a problem, but he sort of was surprised that we had a special concern when I think most of us know that the situation for mental health care in Quebec is, like many other places, very, very weak. And this bill, which would merge the major mental health institutions into yet other bigger things, runs the risk of making that that care even weaker. So that's where the fear comes. Other questions? This is great. No questions. Fantastic. Going once. Going twice. Sold. Over to research. Okay. This is wonderful. I can go sit down. It's my great pleasure to turn the mic over to Philippe Gros, who our Vice Dean Life Sciences, who is going to spend the rest of the time with Shari talking about research.
Thank you very much, David. So this is meant to give an update on our strategic research plan, and mostly focusing on implementation steps to get things going with our priorities. So, as some of you may know, we embarked about a year and a half ago on a strategic research planning exercise, which led to the creation of a strategic research plan, and I think that many of you, if not all, contributed in one way or another to the plan, and certainly provided input. Do I change things here or keyboard? There you go. So I'm not going to describe. Thank you very much. I'm not going to describe it in details, but basically we. There we go. So we took an approach where we organized what we thought was the plan forward for research into three interlocking, if you want, axes or dimension. One is disease areas. To these disease areas, there were prioritized themes of research that could be applied to all of them. And then implementation strategy that could cut across both of these dimensions. So today I'm not going to tell you about neither the disease area nor the prioritized themes. You can see those in the copy of the plan that's available on the website of the Faculty of Medicine. And in fact, I would strongly encourage people to to comment on it. There is a Dropbox that you can put comments on that will help us keep this document alive and move on over the years. What I will focus on today is the implementation strategies. As David told me once, this is really the critical part. I mean, you know, this is fine, but this is really what will make it work or not work. And we had a few. We had knowledge translation. We had strategic grouping, tools and platforms, and human capital. So we will do this with Sherry, myself, and if there's time, we will touch on the last topic here. So, in the implementation of the strategic plan, we tend to sort of view this as either top down or most of the time, because you know we define strategy, but you know, I'm sure many in the room could be arguing that it should be bottom up, and that you know whatever people we hire, whatever they're doing is strategic by definition. So we have a combination of two activities. So we have a combination of things that we think are a good idea, but also we did manage to to find money to set up internal funding for things that will be investigator driven and that are unrelated to the scientific content of the plan. The things that we're going to talk about today and review, if you want, sort of briefly, are the clinician scientist program that we are revamping. Two initiatives that were described in the strategic research plan, one in public and population health, the other one in computational medicine. I'll tell you a little bit about a new opportunity coming from the federal government, the Canada First program. And then Sherry will present an update on three activities that are associated with internal funds from the Faculty of Medicine. And the final one is going to be what we are doing about diversifying sources of funding for our investigators. And Dr. Novak will address this issue if time permits. So I'll start with the first excuse me, I have a bad cold. So the first was a recognition that we need to train more clinician scientists because we think these folks are really important in the way funding agencies are now viewing medical or basic biomedical research. It is now been put in a continuum that tends to be more horizontal and less vertical, i.e., do not study in the infinitesimal level of detail of a particular problem, but rather try to integrate the findings into a continuum that will improve health metrics at the end of the day. At least that's the strategic plan of many of our funding agencies. So clinician scientists, we feel, are play a critical role at the interface of research and clinical practice, and we would like to make a clinician scientist program, a flagship program at McGill, not only by increasing their number, but really by making it one of the best in the country. So we wish to take a long-term view to this, because by nature it does take several years to build such a program. We would like to implement an inclusive approach, and that involves both basic science and clinical departments. We have done this after consultation with some of our leading clinician scientists. We have hired, well, not almost, not, we're going to have a new director of the program. And there's already been several suggestions that have been made on how to implement this new program, including designing a separate entrance path for, let's say, the MD PhD stream, simplifying the funding envelope, including increasing resources, and build up the mentorship portion of the program so that it is continuous over the entire period of training. The second, so this is ongoing. The second initiative is an initiative in public and population health. So what we call initiatives are basically structurally, it's a funding envelope for which we either will be happy to receive application, either one application from a congregation of people that sort of ahead of time get together and propose a strategic research program, or multiple proposals for more specific projects. So there will be terms of reference that will be made available, and so on and so forth, for each of these initiatives. So the concept really is to support novel, non-department-based, interdisciplinary proposals for research and teaching in public and population health. Of course, these should favor novel ideas, build interface, build on strength, and then there are many different areas that can be combined here. These are just a few examples. I'm just back from China, and public health here is over there is an enormous issue. So there are also possibilities of international funding for this type of program. Part of the public and population health program also includes some activities in the global health area. And I just want to mention here that we have a new director for the global health program at McGill, Madhu Pai, who started this summer. And I hope you'll get a chance to meet and speak with him. He has he's extremely dynamic, many new ideas and activities, and this is their website, which cover many of these areas as well. So part of what this initiative is actually provide partial funding for this program. So we will put out call for additional proposal to the faculty at large into this initiative. We think that, we have the terms of reference and so on, so the application bundle should go out early 2015, and this would be a five-year initiative. So the other initiative that that we are putting together is this concept or this initiative of computational medicine. So computational medicine is a fancy word these days, but basically it is meant to address the increasing need for computational analysis for really all aspects of clinical and basic research data that are now being generated, being either imaging, genomics, all kinds of omics, telehealth, and so on and so forth. So there clearly is a need for the development and implementation of novel technologies in this particular interface. We also think that this interface is particularly amenable to interdisciplinary research, and we have a lot of strength both on the clinical side and on the basic science side to create actually programs that are going to be competitive. So the overall goal, again, that's from the terms of reference that we wrote, is to link rich patient-based data set to a research result, prioritize interdisciplinary approaches that will build on established strengths. So again, this is not a gap-filling program. This is really meant to be very competitive. And it's really, we're more familiar with, at least I am, with results from research, but there's also a great need to link those research results to large emerging health-related data set in, areas such as epidemiology, community health, electronic patient record, public policy, and so on and so forth. So we feel like there is a really dynamic interface or multiple interfaces that can be explored through this initiative. Again, we're going to make an application bundle available in a few months after the CIHR sort of storm. And again, this is a 5-year initiative. I just want to mention, as part of this initiative, we, meaning Guillaume Bourque here, has organized a couple of workshops for a program that is just about to be announced by CFI for a cyber infrastructure dedicated envelope that's going to be rolled out by the federal government to fund exactly this type of activity. This is an infrastructure program that's not going to be machines based, but that's actually going to be salary investigator base, so it will provide salary support for many of these activities towards central, in addition to central funding for core infrastructure at Compute Canada. So it looks like there is a very nice sort of merging of interest to support this this interface. Now, the last thing I'm going to talk about is this Canada First Research Fund. So this is a federal program. We don't know much about it, so you'll hear different things on the street. But basically, in the budget of 2014, it was announced that there is a $1.5 billion investment over 10 years to aim to Canadian post-secondary institutions, again, to for research excellence and the long-term economic advantage of Canada. The program, as it was announced, is a ramping up from $50 million in next year's budget all the way to about $200 million a year at steady state 3 years later. So this program, the first call is expected early 2015. So, you know, it's important to sort of warm up the important muscles of the body to capture this wave. Each institution is going to be allowed one award. This number is very uncertain. It clearly is above $5 million simply because you can do the maths here. But we don't know exactly what the maximum is going to be. The envelope is for seven-year programs. It's going to be granted on a competitive basis. The proposals are expected to be thematic, contain multiple projects, but really build on existing strength recognized worldwide. The interesting thing about this program is it's meant to fund things that fall outside of the traditional granting councils, i.e. outside CFI, outside CIHR, outside NSERC, and so on and so forth. So this is really for big ideas, big projects, people who have visions for things that are going to be, you know, propelling us in the next 5, 6, 7 years. The Vice Principal of Research has asked the Faculty of Medicine for a one-pager, and we will be submitting one that will be based on, in part, on the strategic research plan, but we will come back to the community for feedback once we have done that. So as far as my part is concerned, this is it. I'll open it for questions if people have questions for any of these 5 or 6 slides that I just went over. Yes. The strategic plan involves all aspects of health research at McGill, and the research institutes were invited to contribute their own strategic research plan to the writing of this particular plan. The directors of the major research institutes, MUCRI, the Lady Davis, the Douglas, where St. Mary's were on the steering committee of the strategic research plan. So these priorities reflect input from the RI directors as well.
With regard to the clinician scientist program, I think there's kind of a structural problem at the hospitals where there are clinical departments that have very little research and heads that are really not that interested in research, and they hire people, and they hire them with no interest in basic research.
David?
I woke up. So I think that's a legitimate issue. I think if you look at the people who have been hired as academic chairs, all of them have significant research experience, and many of them are very distinguished researchers. The biggest problem we have right now is that even when department heads want to hire someone to do research, especially at the RIMUEC, financial issues have made it very difficult for us to offer them the kind of positions we should be offering them. That I think, is the biggest short-term challenge. It is true that in many
clinical departments, both at the MUC and especially outside the MUC, the clinical needs take priority. The good thing we have in Quebec is there is a thing called the Chercheur Clinicien program, which allows somebody who gets a provincially recognized salary award to have themselves their clinical time essentially bought out either for 50 or 75% of their clinical time, plus they can hire, that clinical director can hire another person to do their call. So in principle, at least for the beginning of their career, there shouldn't be an impediment to hiring researchers. The problem is we also have to have vision among our leaders to make sure that they see this as part of their role, and that's where we're still working on it.
Subsequent to that, the person is hired, and then subsequent to that, the head of the department goes to the head of the research institute and asks for space when it could be done in a more cooperative basis, and I think that would help.
I totally agree. But I think there are some aspects of the internal cultures of our institutions that are outside even my imperial powers. Dr. Robert.
Yeah. Philippe, I think you should be congratulated for this initiative. I think it's great that we're seeing some structured way forward for research in the faculty. My question really relates to the mixed message from you and from our dean. Our dean says we're getting less and less money. You're putting out programs that look exciting, but that are going to require money.
But we secreted away some money specifically for these programs.
So could you give us some idea of the envelopes involved in some of these programs?
Right. So the one that I can say for sure are the ones that Sherry is going to be talking about. So, the Merck award is $4 million. The operating and maintenance. IOF fund from CFI, I think now is at about 1.4 million, and we hope to reach close to that figure for next year. The strategic initiatives from the dean, I could put them on the spot, but that wouldn't be fair. Let's just say that they will be funded. We have found money to do them. The size of the final envelope is not clear yet, but there's going to be enough money in there. It's not going to be super rich, but there's going to be enough money to actually do exciting things. Exactly. It's going to be significant.
So in fact, I did allude to the fact we do have some other sources of money, and what we've decided to do is to really use our strategic plan to focus. So we're making choices. And the things that Philippe talked about are things in which we've made choices to invest in, even though times are tough. We can't invest in we're not going to be investing at the Bloomberg level. It's not $1 billion, but we do think we can muster up a few $100,000 for each of these initiatives that will make a difference to at least get some things going. And hopefully if we become more financially successful or the government becomes less financially draconian, we can put more resources in. Just for people who are not researchers, you should know we're also putting money in to an evaluation and assessment unit for the faculty, also for strategic reasons, because it's shared by all of the educational missions of the faculty. And we're also, I see Raj Agarwal, our new head of the Simulation Center, putting resources into the Simulation Center as part of that educational initiative. So we're really trying in a tough time to take whatever resources we can find and focus them in a few areas that we believe will have strategic benefit over the medium to long term, at the same time as we're trying to just keep the place going.
That's great, thank you. May I ask a follow-up? Some of the points that were raised suggest to me that we might be leading towards the School of Public Health because of the concern about public health.
Well,
is that on the drawing board?
So I have, for a while, I called this my not-secret plan for a School of Public Health. I've come to believe that this may not be the right way to deal with that. I think we have a very good, in fact, oversubscribed program in public health, the Masters of Public Health, and we want to grow that. I don't know if Dr. Parody is here, but
he's
right there. Oh, there he is, waving at me. But we are working on bringing together the things that might constitute a school of public health. But I'm starting to wonder whether, from an operational point of view, it might be better to give ourselves a little bit more flexibility. Schools of public health have a specific statutory role, and they need specific approval by the province, and they just opened one at the Université Montréal, and I don't want to waste my time on constitutional debates and things like that. The goal here is to bring together people who can really make a difference in terms of research and teaching. And we'll try, and we're for now calling it an initiative. There is a group meeting with Gilles from all the different components who are working on trying to come up with a concept of what we're going to do. But I don't want people to go home and say, oh, we're making a school of public health, because we may in the end call it something else.
And public health, again, just back from a trip to China, is the number one issue for a significant portion of the planet. So I think that, from a possibility of leveraging money or co-funding or doing joint initiative on the international scene, I think public health makes a lot of sense from many different angles. Good. Well, thank you very much, Sherry.
I'll stand here. Okay, so my job is to talk about a few internal opportunities that exist. Philippe mentioned them all already. The first is the Merck funds that many of you know about already, an IOF reserve fund that we're trying to provide funding to support core facilities and platforms, and then I'm not really going to talk about bridge funding particularly. I'm going to talk a bit more about internal review and the foundation scheme and some updates from CIHR. So most of you probably know that we were fortunate to get some money from Merck to run this internal competition to support research on, with a translational component. During the first competition, which we just completed, we offered development grants, sort of one-year grants with to support emerging research proposals, and some two-year research grants that were further along in the development phase. In the first competition, we received 44 applications, so clearly this was a popular program. 13 were one-year applications and 31 were two-year applications. In the end, given the constraints on the funding, we awarded 4 one-year grants at $42,500 each and 8 two-year grants at approximately $200,000 each. So we've granted about $1.6 million worth of funding, and there is more money in the pot coming, so we will have a second competition. We would like to make some changes to the parameters of the competition. And I think what we would like to do is see how this first year goes, maybe get some of the reports on for the one-year grants, and then launch another competition. I think I probably everyone knows there were specific areas targeted for this money. They were included sort of infection and inflammation, cardiometabolic diseases, cardiorenal diseases, oncology, neuroscience. I was pretty broad, but these were stipulated by Merck. Okay, so that's one initiative that's providing some funding to supplement the shrinking money outside. We also are about to launch a competition for some funds to support maintenance and operations of equipment, core facilities, core platforms that were originally purchased through CFI funding. Okay, so this is some money that the central administration held in reserve and has now released to faculties, and Philippe did a lot of work to provide the appropriate receipts that were required in order for us to get this money into the Faculty of Medicine. So we're going to launch this competition with priority for applications that are in keeping with the strategic research plan, of course. Our plan currently is to provide funding in sort of packages, sort of $25,000 a year over 3 years, so that there's a bit of security, so it's not just a one-time infusion. The idea is that people will submit applications that show the need, the value of having this money, and we're hoping to target applications that support or provide benefits to the largest number of users. Okay, so that's really the goal. And ideally that there's some kind of sustainability even beyond this three-year period. So things that will be eligible include salaries for people involved in operations and maintenance, service contracts that were not included in the original budget, maintenance and repairs, but not the purchase of new equipment, okay? And not clerical salaries and things like that. So we will announce this very soon with a projected submission deadline of the middle of March, although that's open at the moment. Okay, and now the more controversial issue. So as you all know, for the foundation scheme, we have instituted a policy of mandatory internal review. This is in keeping with the vast majority of the research institutes, the CRI, the MNI, the JGH. We're planning to have a single committee review the proposals, and we're talking about sort of a high-level review, not details of the science, because as you know, for those of you who are applying, the Stage 2 Foundation Scheme applications have a heavier weight on the investigator and the team than on the actual research proposal. And so I have the dates listed up here, and again, we set the dates based on those set by the MUHCRI. We will announce soon the mechanism for submission. I'm assuming we'll try to do this all through some electronic means. I will state, as I said the other day at the Foundation Scheme info session, we're calling this a mandatory review. It is mandatory in that we're strongly, strongly encouraging everyone to submit. It will get you eligibility for any bridge funding that is available should your grant not be successful. We will still sign off on the application if you don't go through the internal review. But the goal, of course, is to be helpful and to have stronger applications. And the evidence seems to show that things that get reviewed by colleagues, and particularly by people in other areas, because remember, a lot of the review for the foundation scheme and the final decisions, particularly for people in what they're calling the gray zone, will be by a multidisciplinary committee. So the idea is to make sure that whatever you're proposing is interpretable by non-specialists. So that's about it for a foundation scheme, although I can give you a bit of update on numbers from CIHR. The numbers have gone down slightly since the registration phase, so they now have, there are 1,366 applications being reviewed in stage one. About 530 of those are from current CIHR grant holders, about 550 from new investigators, and another 270 some odd from individuals who have never held CIHR funding before but are not new investigators. The distribution is pretty typical for CIHR in terms of the pillars. And their expectation is that they will fund between 120 and 250 in total, depending on the budgets submitted. So they can't really tell yet. For the transitional operating grant, which the last open operating grant is this coming March, they're expecting a very high application pressure. Between 3,000 and 3,500 applications are expected. They have moved the deadline up for registration a bit earlier. So the deadline to register is January 9th. The deadline for submission has not changed. It's the 2nd of March. They're doing the earlier deadline in order to get enough reviewers to partake in this large peer review process. Project scheme, which is what is replacing the open operating grant in part, will be announced presumably in early 2015. They don't have details fully worked out yet, but they promised it will be announced soon, and the first round will be due in March of 2016. And you are only allowed to apply for one of those grants. Right, so in any given cycle. Yes, sorry. Yeah. So the good news from CIHR is there still is a plan to increase funding over the next 5 years, right? 10 million a year infusion over the next 5 years, assuming there's no major disaster, change in government that changes the budget, or those other things. So I think that's all I have to say. And I'm happy to take questions and deflect them to Philippe and the dean.
Thank you. Just a very practical question about the stage one. Obviously, people are going to go forward or not based on ranking. Is the CIHR going to reveal the rank following the stage one competition, or will we just be told you're eligible or ineligible?
No, they're supposed to provide the rank and comments from the five reviewers. I believe it's five reviewers application. Yeah.
So thank you.
Yes.
How long is the MERC commitment? Is it renewable just once? It's a one-shot deal, $4 million?
It's a one-shot deal.
So we are in for what, 2-3 years?
Potentially up to 4, depending on what we do with the next version of the competition. Yes.
For the CFI operating fund, you highlighted campus-based core facilities. That would exclude affiliated hospitals?
Because the IOF money for CFIs that went through research institutes and hospitals has been given to the hospitals. So this money is for things that came through McGill.
Yeah, so remember that that the IOF goes with the actual CFIs that are handed out as in order to support them, and so these are IOFs that are associated with CFIs that were awarded on campus. There were similar amounts of money that were sent to the various hospital research centers depending on the CFIs that were held there.
Well, there were some changes through the year, so the IOF is a relatively recent scheme. So there, in the hospital, there are CFI core facilities that are funded in the last 10 years that only the reason ones, reason separate units that got IOF.
Right, but that's true for all the...
That's true on campus, too.
That's true for all CFIs. It's the same program. Wow, that's impressive.
I wanted to ask you about the Merck McGill Fund. I know we had some email exchanges when this was first announced, but I just sort of wanted to bring up the issue in a more general milieu. As far as I understand, this fund is only for campus-based investigators, so those of us that are, that you announced, so those of us that are situated in the research institutes, and I'm not sure if it's only MUHC or all research institutes that are excluded, but I was writing from the standpoint of an MUHC researcher. So we were not eligible for the McGill Merck Fund. Your argument was that the MUHC had its own bundle of funds, whatever, from Merck, which is correct.
It got the same amount of money, if I'm not mistaken.
Pardon me?
The MUHC was awarded an equivalent amount as the entire faculty.
Yes, but the programs are actually different. So whereas McGill...
That was a choice made by the MUHC RI.
Right, but the MUHC is funding junior scientists or something, so that means that there's a large segment of research investigators, those of us that are not junior and those of us that are not campus-based, that are completely excluded from Merck funds. So I know that was, you know, we had this discussion, so I'm not sort of, you know, bringing it up again, but I just wanted the community to be aware of it, particularly those of you that are researchers that are not juniors at the hospitals. You're not eligible for the Merck Fund unless you're changing some of the rules for next year.
Right. So just to point out in part some of the response in our earlier email correspondence, no one who's not in the RI from McGill is eligible for any of the money that's run through the MUHC RI, right? So, I mean, in some sense, it's a comparable exclusion, and we can't control what the RI decides to do with their money, right? So those people in the RI, if they were eligible for this funding as well, would have an advantage over people who are not members of the RI, right? Those people on campus. So it seems...
In the other centers.
Right, right. So, I mean, it seems... I understand that there's some exclusion, but it's an exclusion on this end as well. Dave?
I think the MUHC RI decided on a very specific approach. So I strongly recommend that you try to influence that decision process as well. Also, on the other hand, we opened the door in that people that are, you know, in some of the research institutes could be co-PI on applications that are based on campus. In other words, you know, we try to accommodate, understanding that, you know, this is a translational type of award. Therefore, you know, it would be beneficial to actually have people that are more in a hospital environment. But I do support the, you know, what Jerry just said. It's that's just the way it is.
So we have David Rosenblatt and Marshall.
Sorry, If I missed it at the beginning, I was late. But with these new initiatives and strategic plans and such, I guess there's two ways to look at it. These could be enabling to bring in all kinds of new blood, or these could be targeted at the existing cadre or the existing cohort of people in the room. From where I'm sitting, it's not easy to get PhD tenure track faculty to join, and in the hospital it doesn't seem that there's going to be a lot of MDs coming from the next 5 years. So is there a recruitment bottleneck that could prevent us from flourishing with these new opportunities?
So there's no question that we are in a very difficult time when it comes to recruitment, especially of clinicians. This is outside. Obviously, there has been a reduction in the complement of positions at the MUHC in particular, and we don't know how the health reform that I described at the beginning will affect what goes on in places like the Jewish or the Douglas. So I think clinicians is one issue. We do have some advantages in Quebec, as I said earlier, for clinician scientists. If we can package them well, we can often get them in despite the limitations of the PEM. For basic scientists, we are fairly saturated on we've hired a lot of people over the last few years, so we can't hire many, many people. But we continue to hire people, and there is a turnover that is happening. We are in constant negotiations. Mara's not here because this week to defend herself, but she's in constant negotiations with provost office to try and fix the problem and continue to recruit. Because of that, we've still been able to recruit small numbers of excellent people, not as in, let's say, 5 years ago when we were recruiting 20, 30 people a year. We're not at that level, but we are able to recruit. In addition, we've been successful in identifying specific opportunities for leadership recruitments that have been beneficial to the overall functioning of the place. So in the short term, I suspect most of this will be with the current crop of people. But I would remind folks that we have hired a lot of people. So a lot of that current crop is just coming into their own right now and can really make use of this kind of investment because they're just getting into their mid-career where they can be very productive. But I'm very mindful of the fact that we had a full hiring freeze in the 1990s, and we're still paying a price for that now. And so we will do everything possible to fight a full hiring freeze. We'll continue to try and recruit no matter what. But that's something we work very hard at, because if we stop recruiting for a significant period of time, 15 years from now, our goose will be cooked.
This is a point of clarification. I understood that the project scheme, you can only apply for one project. However, what about the transitional open operating grant program?
I don't believe they specified. I don't recall that having been indicated. However, on the UD call the other day, we were asked to discourage applications that are just hastily put together because everyone wants to get in on this last operating grant because they're already expecting, 3,500 applications. So I don't think the message is you're limited, but please don't go overboard, is sort of what they're telling us. Yeah.
So I think David was...
Yes, mine would be, again, both a comment and a question, since I only have one question ever, and it's just reframed in different formats. Philippe, when you gave your presentation... You noticed that, by the way, but I think it's still important to do it. When you gave your presentation, you said that there was representation from the research institutes in putting forward the strategic plan. And now we see there's pools of funds that are sequestered in different places. This is coming up from Rima's question. And as you know, there are campus-based people, particularly at the Genome Center, who have affiliations with the research institute who presumably can tap into that funds. If there are situations where it would be strategically useful to have investigators, research institutes on your translational, do you have a mechanism to discuss it amongst the leadership to take full advantage of our resources and our brains so we put forward the best project?
Yeah, I think we would be very open to the idea of
that, though. Is it going to push from the university or the research? You have different bodies
with good intentions, who's going to push it forward?
I think you just nominated yourself. But I think the look.
Put that up anyone.
No. But I think, in all fairness, the MUHCRI has decided to focus. First of all, they got their money before we did, so they decided to take a particular approach that Rima described. And they're also very sort of, systems or disease based. In other words, they'll run a competition on, let's say, non-communicable, let's say, diabetes, and so on and so forth. We have no. We've decided to use a different approach to open it up completely. I think that if there was a situation where, a particular amount of money could be leveraged from DRI to put in a specific envelopes and, let's say, for a thematic competition, I can see this happening.
Presumably investigators, just on an individual basis, investigators at DRI could find a partner based on campus and put together a joint project, perhaps.
Yes, so that we have encouraged that, in particular because some of the translational component is important and could be brought by people who are in a hospital environment, as opposed to sort of only basic scientists who do drug screening on cell-free or cell-based assay. So, yeah, it does make sense.
We're 10 minutes over, so maybe one more question. It goes to 6? We got 20 more minutes. You can ask many more questions.
But we also have Olivia Novak.
Okay. Sherry, there's one aspect you did not bring up, which was the institutes within CIHR. There was an order in August that basically says, we'll keep the 13 research institutes, but we'll dissolve all of the advisory boards, and we will create 3 or 4 advisory boards. We will remove all of the support that the institutes have from within CIHR Central. And most importantly, half of the budget is going to be allocated. It won't be cut, but half of the budget has to be allocated to multi-institute projects with topics that are approved by CIHR Central. This has caused a huge reaction because all of the communities that are thriving within the different institutes are feeling targeted by this. In the last few days, there has been several letters going to Governing Council and to the Deputy Minister. My question is, has McGill, either through the Associate Dean's Research, the VP Research, taken a position with respect to this very dramatic change that the President of CIHR and Governing Council are imposing, and it's not clear whether they're acting actually within the law of CIHR or not?
So, Philippe and I were just talking about this a bit earlier. My understanding is that the VP Research Office is looking into this right now. On the UD calls, what we were told was all of this was, they were thinking about making these changes and that it had not yet been approved. So if it has now been approved...
it was approved on August 26th, and they're implementing them right now.
So I can tell you that on at least in September, probably in October, on one of these calls, they indicated that it had not yet gone through the system to be approved, the changes to be approved. So I think we're looking into it. I'm sure we will develop a response. We'll probably consult with the community to do that. But I have not seen the approved.
I have to say that if we are going to have a response, we'll have to consult the community because my sense is there isn't a uniform opinion about what should be done. There are some people who are very great fans of the institutes, and I know for a fact there are other people who are not and who would prefer the money to be used the way that's being described. So I think before we issued a community-based, spoke on behalf of the entire community, we would have to consult to get a sense of what people really believe. Otherwise, it's just the opinions of the leadership. Jim.
Say that I find it odd that there are so many issues that have been raised that are relevant to the research institutes, and we have not had any, we don't have any directors, it seems to me, of the research institutes present at this meeting to absorb the views of the faculty and to sort of translate their end of it into something that's sort of coherent. So it's just an expression of disappointment in a sense that we're not fully, we don't have full representation from all of the people that I think should be here, you know.
Well, there are people here who are active on the leadership of different research institutes, so I hope they'll bring back at least some of these messages to those folks. Yeah, certainly, obviously, those people are invited, always, and invited also to other leadership functions within the faculty. In case people don't know, there is a regular meeting of all the research institute directors chaired by Philippe Charia, and I are there as well. And there's also the Faculty Leadership Council, as it's called. It meets monthly, at which all the department heads are present, and all the associate deans, vice deans, but all the research institute directors are invited to that as well.
Okay, so if that's it, I'll turn things over to Olivia. She's going to talk about commercialization. How does it work? Is this it? Okay. Okay, I'll come back to the slide afterwards, but just as an introduction, my name is Olivia Novak. I was the commercialization officer. Now I'm known as the invention development manager for the Faculty of Medicine. So I'm in charge of Faculty of Medicine, but we also have someone at the Jewish General Hospital, Nadia Noor. So she's on location over there for the researchers that are there. And we also have someone at the MNI, that takes care of the MNI researchers and also the MUHC researchers. So what do we do? What's the role of our group? Well, the first role is to help researchers develop their inventions. So if the invention is too early to protect, we protect usually by patenting or copyright or other forms of intellectual property protection. But if it's too early, what we do is we advise on what's needed to bring it to the level where it could be interesting for industry or where we can protect it, actually. So we can advise you on the kind of data you think you can generate and, you know, some aspects that you didn't think of and what industry is really looking for. If your invention that you have, that you disclose is ready for commercialization, we have a whole process in our office for that, and obviously, we take care of all the patenting and all the costs associated with commercialization, with the legal agreements and everything. But we also, what we really do a lot is we try to match you with industry. We bring you to a lot of meetings with companies. You discuss the project. Sometimes we can get a collaboration going. Sometimes it's a licensing play where the technology is licensed to a company and they develop it. It really depends on your need and you know, what the researcher is looking for. So we offer that service. And for the people that really want to start their own company, if the technology is right and the, you know, and the maturity of the technology is right, we can also help you set up your own company. So we have, you know, what it takes for that. And it could be for researchers, but it could also be for the postdocs, for the graduate students, whoever is interested in that service. So that's one of the roles we have and the service we offer. Another thing we really do a lot is we review all the legal agreements that have intellectual property terms. So simple MTAs or CDAs will have some strings, and sometimes you just sign off on it. You don't really understand what you're signing off. So we're there as a support to explain to you what it means and to advise you and if you should accept that or if we need to negotiate something different depending on your need. So we are there to support you on all the agreements that have intellectual property. We also provide guidance on all the, I would say, the commercialization grants
which are unique. Some of you know of those, like the proof of principle grants, but we also have other opportunities that are, for example, calls of proposal for different companies. Merck is one, but there are some external ones where we could really help you draft something that would be received really well by industry. So, you know, many of you do not have the expertise to identify the right market, to discuss the medical need, to discuss the competition, what kind of products are out there and what stage. So we do all that drafting for you, and the goal of that is really to have better application, to get some money that you would normally not be able to get if you don't really know how to draft commercialization grants. So, next slide. Okay. So upcoming opportunities. We're at the end of the year right now. Many of our opportunities are in September, but right now what's coming, the date has not been announced yet, but it's always usually on February 14, maybe the 18, depending on when it falls. It's the proof of principle grant. That's a grant that's strictly a commercialization grant. It's not for fundamental science. You have to have a product that when you perform the research that you propose in the grant, it will be something that industry will be interested to license or to develop. So that grant is very specific, and we help you draft more than half the grant because it's really on commercialization aspects and markets. And yes. They are planning to revamp it maybe in the next year, but you know, we've been told that for the past 2 years, but it didn't happen yet. So we are going to have another competition in February, and most likely another one next September. Usually they are the beginning of September is the call. So there's two, this is two different grants. You have the POP one, which is something that the researcher, it's something that you don't need a company to apply for. That's an amount of $160,000. The second grant is larger. It's with a company, and you have to have the support, also the financial support from the company. It's a POP two grant, and that's about $600,000. So that's one opportunity that's coming soon. We also have the PSVT3 program. Many of you are not aware of that. We've been having it for many years. This used to be about $1 million grant. We had three competitions per year. This year, because of the budget constraints, it has been reduced to $400,000. We are told that this is going to continue on the next year, and usually the deadline for that is end of May, but we don't know yet how much money it will be. Is it going to be increased back to what it was before, or is it going to be lower than the $400,000? This is a really big grant application, about 100 pages of, it's almost like a business plan. So it requires a lot of work from our group. And, you know, it was worth it when it was $1 million. I'm not sure it's worth it if it really decreases to, I don't know, $200,000. A CIHR proof of principle, it might be easier in that case. I didn't put on this slide, but we have companies that come to our office weekly that have specific needs on technologies they're looking for. Sometimes it's early stage. They're looking at the target level. Sometimes they want specific mice models, all sorts of expertise. And if you discuss with us more often, we know what your expertise is. We know what you have unique. And like that, we can match you when a company's looking to do a collaboration or a partnership or they have some product they want to test on a specific model. So, you know, we encourage everyone to discuss with us so we know exactly what you do. So when we have these requests, we could, you know, we have a good match. And those come, we don't know. Sometimes it's they bombard us in September. There's 50 companies that want to come and visit McGill, and we try to arrange one-on-one meetings depending on the topic they're looking for. But sometimes we do group meetings. We've had the recent one was Blue Line, and we also had CDRD who came maybe a month and a half ago. So we invite, you know, we look at what they're looking for. We match with the researchers that have that expertise, those kinds of projects. And then, you know, we try to arrange meetings on the same day so we get, you know, more money into your lab and your inventions, your technologies get developed. I'm just going to go back on the first page here where I'm told that the Faculty of Medicine is also going to hire shortly an industry relation person, and the role of that person will be to really identify what are the core facilities, their infrastructure, and the expertise, and bundle that into a resource, web-based resource that industry can access, and it will be easier, you know, to match expertise and get more money in your labs and for your projects. Okay. It is still a Canadian company. What we do to go around it is many companies have a subsidiary here. They have to have some sort of research center. It can't be just an office. So many companies do have it, or sometimes they establish it a few months before applying, which is not, you know, we've had that before.
Other questions or comments? If, yes.
What is the relationship between what you're talking about and the McGill Technology Transfer Office?
There is no more McGill Tech Transfer Office. It used to be called OTT a long time ago. When I joined McGill, we switched from OTT to the Commercialization Office. Now they've switched us again under the VPRRR as the Innovation and Partnership Office. Basically, you know, we're the same office that changed its name, but now this is where we are. The Tech Transfer Office of McGill is us, the IDEA team.
But the key difference is they're now more peripherally embedded in order to be closer to the researchers. So instead of people having to go to the OTT office, there is representatives, as you saw, of OTT, or what was OTT, now it has a new name, here at the hospitals to make sure that there are people around who can pick up on ideas and work with the local people to translate them more effectively and to get to know the areas. The opposite of Bill 10, exactly. Very, very good way to end it. The other thing is, I would say that we're actually quite appreciative to the VPRAR's office. This is one of those programs that when we had a meeting of all the research directors from the hospitals and everything, and there were no negative comments, and that's almost never happens. So they must be doing a great job. So thank you very much. I'm going to, unless there are other questions or burning issues, hearing none, I'm going to thank you all for coming and wish you a good evening. Thanks a lot.